The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn.
Tonight, we're on the case in Elmhurst, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. The quiet Midwestern community became the scene of a disturbing mystery when 21-year-old Lori Borowski simply vanished on her way to work. As police tried to retrace her last known steps, they never could have imagined the trail of terror they would discover.
May 15th, 1982. While most of Elmhurst was still having their first cup of coffee, real estate broker Don Stibbe was in a hurry to start his long day showing houses.
I had an appointment. I had to stop by the office to pick up my briefcase.
Don had asked assistant manager Lorraine Borowski to open up the real estate office at 8:30. To make sure that all of his paperwork was ready to go. But as he was parking his car, he noticed that the office was still dark.
The office is locked, it's empty, no one's there.
Don knew it wasn't like Lori to be late.
The concern was where she at and what happened to her.
As Don walked to the front door, he became even more concerned. He noticed a set of keys, a pair of women's shoes, and a makeup case strewn about the area. Fearing they might be Lori's, he contacted Elmhurst police.
A patrol officer was dispatched to the scene, and he explained to the patrol officer the fact that she wasn't there and that these items were found there.
Police tested the keys to see if they were Lori's.
They took those keys, they put them into the door. Realized that those keys opened that door. Those keys belonged to Lori Borowski.
The officer concluded the shoes and the makeup case were Lori's as well. The situation appeared suspicious enough for him to immediately call in a report.
She was described as a very conscientious employee, very punctual and dedicated to her job. The fact that the keys were laying there, the fact that there were shoes laying there, all suggested that some sort of a struggle had happened.
Detective Sergeant John Milner was dispatched to the scene.
This just doesn't feel right. We felt it was foul play. We said, let's start now, full speed ahead.
A criminal investigation was launched. Detectives went to Lori's home just a few blocks away. Her roommate allowed investigators to do a thorough search of her room. It was obvious that Lori had been there that morning.
The clothes she'd been wearing the night before were folded in the apartment. A hairdryer was still plugged in the bathroom. There was a wet towel on the bed. She had gotten ready to go to work.
Based on an examination of her apartment, police were confident that Lori had gone to work as planned.
There was nothing missing from Lori's apartment to suggest to us that she ran away.
There was no indications that she was upset about anything or would have just disappeared on her own.
Police canvassed the complex, hoping to find eyewitnesses.
and they quickly found a neighbor who had seen Lori leave for work.
A neighbor saw her leave the house sometime between 8 and 8:15 and gave a clothing description of what she was wearing that morning.
The neighbor said Lori was wearing a beige top and green khaki pants.
She was seen leaving for work around 8 o'clock, 8:15. And then the owner of the business found the keys around 8:45.
There was a very, very small window of time where she had apparently vanished.
Investigators were troubled that someone could have grabbed Lori just steps from her office in broad daylight. It was hard to fathom. Elmhurst was considered to be a safe town.
Elmhurst was not a town with a lot of crime, and this was a very busy area. I mean, this is one of the busiest intersections in the city.
It's not a real urban area like a downtown New York or Chicago. It's a suburban area that has foot traffic as well as cars.
As investigators tried to make sense of what happened to Lori, they feared they were dealing with an extremely brazen criminal.
If Lori was abducted, whoever abducted her didn't really care about who was there. Therefore, they're very dangerous.
Knowing that Lori's life might hang in the balance, detectives shifted the investigation into high gear.
Officers were assigned to conduct a canvas of the shopping center, and it's a large shopping center, quite a few businesses there, and it covers quite a bit of ground. So officers contacted anybody literally they could find at that time to ask them, did you see anything?
I talked to several of the shop owners in that shopping center to see if anyone had been in the area or had arrived at work at about the time that the incident would have happened.
No one had seen an actual abduction take place, but several people reported seeing a suspicious van cruising around the area of the real estate office.
Two of the people mentioned a reddish-orange van, and then a third person mentioned a van that they described as older and in poor condition.
There were also reports of a silver car lurking in the parking lot.
We had one guy that thought around that time of the morning he saw a young lady arguing with a guy in a silver car. It looked like she was almost fighting with this guy. He thought it was simply a domestic disturbance.
It was his impression that this person was actually engaged in fighting the person as opposed to trying to get away.
The shop owner said that his view of the incident had been temporarily blocked by passing traffic. And once he could see the area again, the couple was gone. And so was the silver car.
He never saw anyone actually dragged into the car, nor did he see the vehicle leave. And he was very cooperative. I mean, he made every effort that he could to cooperate with us and try to help us develop what he saw.
Police believe the man may have witnessed the struggle, which led to Lori's abduction, but they needed to be sure.
The vehicle description was somewhat limited, and his description of the woman involved in the struggle was somewhat limited as well. He was able to tell us that it was a white female. He said she was wearing a yellow top, and Lori had been described as wearing a beige top. From that distance, beige, yellow, you know, could have been.
Instinct and experience told investigators that if they didn't find Lori soon, they might not find her at all.
We wanted to make sure we turned over every stone that we could. This was so important to all of us. We want this girl found okay. We want this girl found alive.
With that goal in mind, detectives turned to Lori's family and friends, hoping they could point them to a suspect. Mark Borowski was only 10 years old when his sister Lori went missing. He can still remember the terror he felt when police told his parents that she disappeared on her way into work.
We're just like, what happened? Where's Lori? Anybody hear from her? You know, what's going on?
When investigators informed Lori's family of what they had found just outside of her office, the room went silent.
I think we all kind of knew something bad had happened.
Lori was from a huge family of 15 brothers and sisters. As soon as she had graduated high school, she got a job. Her brother remembers being impressed with his older sister's work ethic.
She was going to go far. She moved out of the house at like 18, worked her butt off.
Lori was making the most of the opportunity she had at the real estate office. She had already been promoted after just a few months on the job.
She was totally excited. She was professional. She was moving up quick. Smart, talented. Nothing could stop her.
Investigators now believe that Lori had been abducted. They hope that her family might help them identify a suspect before it was too late.
There's a total race against time in a case like this. We have to find her ASAP.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Police learn that Lori recently had been dating two men. Detectives believe that jealousy could have been the motive behind Lori's disappearance.
We started following them and watching what they were doing. We were hoping that we'd maybe get them startled if they had been involved with the crime.
While police watched, neither man did anything incriminating. In fact, both cooperated fully with the investigation.
Both of them had alibis. Those alibis checked out. There was nothing there that jumped out as being suspicious.
After clearing the two men, investigators asked those closest to Lori if there was anyone else they should check out. And one person came to mind.
Lori's parents were very helpful. Her mom said that she did date a guy. He maybe hit her or slapped her. So certainly wanted to find out who that was.
Detectives heard several other stories about this ex-boyfriend that raised red flags.
One of the people she worked with in the real estate office said that Lori had told her that this boyfriend had been seen loitering outside the office.
Lori had even expressed her fear to employees at her apartment complex.
There was a custodian where she lived that mentioned Lori would try to keep the person from seeing her. She had suspected he may have broken a window in a previous apartment she lived in.
Detectives brought the man in for questioning.
He admitted that they had stopped dating. And while it would have been his preference to try to renew the relationship, she was in the process of dating somebody else, and he wasn't going to force the issue. That's not consistent with what other people told us.
Police confronted him about whether he had been stalking Lori.
He denied that he had been sitting outside her business or following her.
Investigators sensed that the young man was withholding important information,
especially about where he was on the morning of Lori's disappearance.
He didn't give a specific alibi or accounting of his whereabouts.
Detectives asked him to submit to a lie detector test.
He was polygraphed regarding his involvement. Did he have any involvement in the incident? Had he done anything to Lori? And the polygraph indicated he was truthful in his responses.
During the polygraph, the young man adamantly denied any involvement in Lori's disappearance. And after the exam, he was able to be more specific about his whereabouts the morning Lori went missing.
He was later further interviewed and said that every Saturday, without fail, he went to his parents' home and mowed their lawn, so that's where he would have been at that time.
When several witnesses confirmed that story, police cleared him of any role in Lori's abduction. While detectives were forced to start over from scratch, Lori's family continued to do amazing work getting the community involved in the investigation.
We had everybody looking for her. Hundreds of people. We had neighbors, we had kids on bikes, everybody putting out posters and flyers. We covered from Illinois to Indiana to Wisconsin. Everywhere.
Lori's family was overwhelmed by the large number of volunteers who were searching for their missing loved one.
It was just comforting knowing that she made such an impact on everybody's life. You don't realize it until you need it. And it's like, wow.
The outpouring of support also helped jumpstart the investigation.
When the word got out that she was missing, we started getting a lot of calls from people offering information or offering their insights into, what they thought might have happened.
One of those calls came from a man who appeared to have critical information.
He said, on the morning Lori went missing, he was in a nearby liquor store parking lot when he heard a frightening noise coming from a parked car.
He heard what sounded like somebody yelling coming from the trunk and some sounds as if someone were struggling to get out of the trunk.
He heard pounding on the trunk and screaming. When you hear screaming and kicking, something's not right.
When he looked down at the back of the silver car, he noticed something even more troubling.
His attention was drawn to the trunk. He actually saw what looked like dents as if someone were trying to kick their way out.
The idea just seemed too surreal to be true. The man was convinced his imagination was playing tricks on him.
He said, "Are you okay? Is anybody in there?" And the screaming and pounding stopped.
The caller told police that just as he was getting ready to examine the trunk more closely, the owners of the car, two frightening-looking men, quickly approached him.
They came out of the liquor store and came toward that car. And he said at that point they gave him a dirty look, and he decided maybe that wasn't the time to investigate further.
The man said he felt intimidated by their threatening looks.
They stared him down. They just were glaring at him, and he felt it'd be in his best interest to walk away from the car.
The caller told detectives he assured himself that there was no one in the trunk. But the situation still troubled him enough that as the silver car drove away, he wrote down its license plate number. When he saw the news coverage of Lori Borowski's case, he suddenly wondered if it might be connected to what he had heard.
He had no idea at that point Lori had disappeared, and when he found out that she had, he thought, hey, the police better know about this. So he gave us that information.
At that time, he thought, hey, maybe this is her.
So then he did call us, which we were thankful for.
But detectives found the man's story a bit strange. If he was concerned enough to write down the license plate number, why didn't he immediately call the police?
Regardless of whether it was Lori Brodsky in the trunk or someone else, you would like to think he would report that to the police. But for whatever reason, he decided not to until he found out Lori had disappeared.
Investigators believed that that tip might be the break they had been waiting for. The story seemed to line up with other tips about a silver car and had taken place just miles away from where Lori had been abducted, minutes after she was last seen.
When they called us, we were all excited. Oh my God, pounding in the trunk of a car, screaming. This is it, you know, so we jumped on that right away. I mean, this is huge.
The license plate number quickly allowed police to locate their new prime suspect.
The car was registered to a person that lived in Chicago. A couple of the investigators from the Elmhurst Police Department got with Chicago detectives and went out and contacted this person.
Detectives wasted no time confronting the man about the disturbing story.
They basically explained to him why they were there, and the fact that this noise was coming from the trunk.
Investigators weren't sure what to think when the man willingly cooperated and offered up a bizarre explanation of the sounds heard coming from his car.
He had purchased 2 live goats to barbecue that weekend.
He said, hey, I bought these goats from this farm for this event that they were going to have.
They were in the trunk of the car, and he was on his way home with them when the witness saw what he saw.
The detectives asked the man for proof that his incredible story was true.
The officers said, let's see your car. I mean, of course, they're thinking God knows what's in his trunk of his car.
But when the man opened his trunk, police didn't see any sign that Lori had been inside.
They saw coarse animal hair consistent with a goat or a farm animal.
Amazingly, the man had been telling the truth.
There was no human hairs. There weren't anything in the trunk to look like somebody human was in the trunk. They looked at it very closely, and they were satisfied with his response.
The examination of the trunk seemed to corroborate what he was telling us.
The man was officially cleared as a suspect. The once promising lead had turned into a time-consuming dead end.
We were disappointed, to say the least, but at the same time, I have to admit I was a little bit relieved because I hate to think that had she been in the trunk, we wouldn't have found out about this till 4 days later.
It was bad for us because we thought we had another good lead that led nowhere.
Detectives were at a loss. They began searching police databases from all over the state, looking for similar crimes.
You spend all of your time looking for other reports of people that might have been taken in such a manner, anything that would tie into this case. And nothing like that was coming up.
But just when it seemed as if the case was in danger of going cold, police got a tip about a strange man with a disturbing obsession. His name was Joseph Kirkwood, and police in a neighboring county had just arrested him for assault. While they were booking him, they discovered evidence that he might have been involved in Lori Borowski's disappearance. In his wallet were dozens of business cards belonging to female real estate agents. Investigators wondered if this disturbing obsession had him stalking Lori's real estate office on the morning she was abducted. And there was more.
An officer who was familiar with Kirkwood, he told us that he had an explosive temper and that he'd had some martial arts training.
Elmhurst police were also told that Joseph Kirkwood had just been released from a mental institution the day before Lori disappeared.
and there was physical evidence that appeared to connect him to her abduction.
The time Kirkwood was arrested for that most recent assault, he had some injuries to his hands that appeared to be old injuries. The officer described them as gouges. They were unhealed.
Investigators pressed Kirkwood for an explanation about the suspicious gouges on his hands.
He was unable to explain how he'd gotten them.
Detectives searched Kirkwood's DMV records and discovered an additional clue to link him to the case.
Our background check revealed that he had access to a silver car.
On the morning of Lori's abduction, an eyewitness had reported seeing a man and a woman engaged in a heated argument standing next to a silver car in the real estate office's parking lot.
When we found out that Kirkwood was driving a silver car, we thought, oh man, this might be our guy.
Investigators brought Kirkwood into the Elmhurst police station for an interrogation and showed him a picture of Lori Borowski.
He said he recognized her, he knew who she was, that he would sometimes see her walking to work and that he would wave to her and that she would wave back. He said that he would like to have gone out on a date with her.
But as the interview went on, it became clear that the whole relationship was in Kirkwood's twisted imagination.
He gave inconsistent answers regarding the nature of his contact with her.
Detectives were quickly becoming convinced that Joseph Kirkwood had been involved in Lori's abduction.
He seemed to be erratic. His answers weren't really clear. This might be a very good suspect because of the way he answered his questions.
Kirkwood was also evasive about his whereabouts that day.
He said he was not in Elmhurst. He wasn't more specific.
When Kirkwood agreed to take a lie detector test, detectives believed it was just a matter of time before he confessed.
So I then put him on the polygraph instrument and I asked the questions. What I do is I'll ask a wide variety of questions. Many are unrelated to the crime, but I try to get a baseline for his behavior. I like to see the way he moves his eyes when he answers, how he thinks, how he breathes, how he moves his hands, feet, and arms, and everything.
But the results were not what investigators expected.
He totally denied it, and he was adamant about it. I felt that he was telling the truth.
Kirkwood passed the exam and also provided police with the name of a friend he had been with the day Lori went missing. The confirmed alibi left investigators with no choice but to rule him out as a suspect.
I felt comfortable that he was not involved.
There was really nothing to connect him to this case. All of the people that we had been given information about had been contacted. At that point, we were at the end of our string in terms of leads to follow up on.
We put it on a back burner and we just hope that someone will call with information.
At that point in the investigation, detectives were forced to concede that the odds of finding Lori alive were very low.
And someone just disappears under the circumstances and you hear nothing. I think you can only assume the worst.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
summer became fall, and both the weather and the case had gone cold. Then, detectives got the call that changed the course of the investigation.
So about 5 months later, kids were out here playing, and through the woods right there, they found what they thought to be a body.
It was found in an area near a cemetery that was out of the way. You really couldn't get to it unless you knew where it would be.
It was just happenstance that two young boys were walking through looking for a place to build a fort when they happened to find skeletal remains.
Investigators arrived and quickly confirmed the children's worst fears. It was a dead body, and the condition of the remains made identifying the individual very difficult.
The body was in very, very poor condition. In fact, you couldn't recognize if it would be a man or a woman other than the clothing.
Officers on the scene wondered if the unidentified victim was Lori Borowski.
The investigators on scene recalled the incident involving Lori and asked what Lori was wearing the day that she disappeared. We gave them a description of her clothing, and that clothing matched perfectly. Based on that, we had a very reasonable assumption that it was probably her.
Detectives hoped to find evidence that might identify her killer. But the area where the body was found offered no additional clues.
We took samples of everything that we could around the body, looking for anything that anyone may have left behind, and didn't find anything of any relevance for the crime scene. And remember, back then, we didn't have DNA or any of that, so that's one thing that we didn't specifically look for.
The county coroner's office asked for access to Lori's dental records.
And they matched, so we knew for sure it was Lori Borowski.
The coroner went on to determine that Lori died from multiple stab wounds.
They found indications of a sharp instrument that had struck bone at a couple of different locations, both in the upper chest and in the back.
For Lori's family, the tragic news shattered their last glimmer of hope.
I remember going into the bathroom and just curling up into a ball and crying.
Investigators who had been working the case for months were also crushed.
The air was let out of our balloon, and we felt that we had hope that she was still alive. We just hoped that we would be able to help her. When that happened, we realized that all hope was gone, and the only thing we could do now was try to resolve it by determining who did this and bring them to justice.
The Lori Borowski abduction investigation had officially become a homicide case. And investigators weren't going to stop until they tracked down her killer.
It intensifies everybody's efforts, but we had very few leads to follow up on.
For us, it was back to square one because was she murdered by someone who knew her? Was she murdered by a stranger? Was it anybody that we've already talked to and then maybe we have to revisit?
Just as the Lori Borowski murder investigation was getting underway, Detective Sergeant Milner was asked to help police in a neighboring county polygraph a suspect who they believed might be connected to her murder and several others in the area. The man's name was Tommy Cocorales.
They said, you know, we don't know whether or not he's involved, but could you polygraph him anyway? So I'm now being presented with somebody that's really not a suspect, but might be somebody who might have more information about this crime.
As Milner ran the polygraph session, his questions grew more and more pointed.
I began to interrogate Tommy because it appeared as though he was like holding back. He was very erratic, somewhat standoffish, somewhat quiet. He only answered questions if I was very, very specific about how I asked them.
At first, Cocorales denied knowing Lori. But Detective Milner continued to turn up the pressure, and the 22-year-old finally cracked.
He had a story to tell.
A disturbing story that was unlike anything the seasoned investigator had ever heard in his life.
It's just evil.
Cocorales told them that on the morning of Lori Borowski's murder, he and his brother Andrew pulled up alongside the 21-year-old and asked her if she needed a ride.
The girl says, "No, I'll walk." And they go to the car and park. They got out of the car, put one hand around her mouth, opened the just side door, locked her in, then took off.
They grabbed her off the street, which is consistent, of course, with the evidence that was found. His hand over her mouth so the screams wouldn't be heard. Her shoes would be missing because she's probably kicking and fighting.
Cocorales blamed most of the horrible crime on his brother and their gang, known as the Ripper Crew.
He said the leader of this group had some kind of a way of getting the others to participate. It was a cult. It's evil. It's rare, thank God, that we don't see much of that.
He claimed that after they had Lori restrained in their van, they took her to a remote location where the gang viciously assaulted her.
They took her to a hotel. They gagged her so she couldn't scream, and they handcuffed her to the bed. They beat her, they raped her, and they did things to her that I just can't say for the TV audience. It was despicable. I couldn't believe that any human being would do what they did to another human being. It was disgusting.
Cocorales said that when the unspeakable murder was over, they dumped Lori in the woodsy area where she was later discovered.
They really didn't care about their victim at all. It told me that they just wanted to get rid of the body and just be on their way without spending any effort at all of additional concealment. It told me that they used the body and just left it behind.
Detective Sergeant Milner still remembers the horror he felt in the interrogation room when Tommy Cocorales told him his unimaginable tale of depravity.
We look for this girl, and we think we're going to find her. And not only is she killed, they did this to her while she was alive. So it's emotional. But as I'm interviewing him in the room, I have to have empathy with this evil person and continue the rapport for him to continue to tell me what he's told me. It's hard. It's hard to do. It's very sickening. It's evil.
Cocorales claimed that he had been ordered by his brother and the leader of their gang to remain silent about Lori's murder. Cocorales went on to tell the detective that Lori was chosen simply because she was an easy target that day.
They would pick up anybody. That's the scary thing about this. It could have been anybody. It could have been anybody's daughter, sister, mom, anybody. Lori was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
And his story would only grow more disturbing as he told police about the string of other murders the Ripper Crew had committed.
This crew abducted, killed, and mutilated 17 women or so. And to the best of our knowledge, most all were randomly just grabbed off the street. It's just unbelievable how anything like this can occur, how any human being could do this to another human being. It's unacceptable.
You think One of them will say, hey, don't do that. But they were just each as bad as the other, egging each other on with what they did.
Tommy Cocorales admitted to being present during many of the killings. But it was clear to the detective that Cocorales felt little remorse for what he had done.
Tommy Cocorales is very much of a follower. I think that he could be led to do most anything. I think that he doesn't have empathy for others. I think he's lacking compassion. He is only concerned about himself, as all of these guys were. It's all about them.
At the end of Detective Milner's polygraph exam, Tommy Cocorales was arrested and charged with the murder of Lori Borowski. When police tracked down Andrew Cocorales and confronted him with his brother's story, he confessed to Lori's murder and admitted the savage crime was just one of more than a dozen the gang had committed. DuPage County prosecutors wanted both brothers and the other members of the Ripper crew to face the death penalty.
We had to do everything in our power to make sure they never walked the street again.
But as prosecutors prepared their case against Tommy Cocorales, they learned he had an IQ of less than 70. Based on his diminished intellectual capacity, they chose not to seek the death penalty.
We felt that it wouldn't be appropriate. He agreed to plead guilty and accept 70 years.
But prosecutors had no reservations about moving forward with capital murder charges against his brother, Andrew Cocorales. In March of 1987, almost 5 years after Lori's murder, DuPage County prosecutors told jurors what they believe happened to Lori that day.
She lived three blocks from the realtor. She walked there. A neighbor saw her leave about 8:15. They pulled up in the van, grabbed her. There was a struggle, pulled her right out of her shoes, threw her in the back, away they went.
The utter depravity of the crime was made certain to the jury.
I wanted them to know how dangerous these people are, how many people suffered. And I really wanted them to know these guys don't deserve to live on the same planet as we do. They were not human, in my opinion. The crimes were so horrible, what these guys did to so many young women. They suffered before they died.
The prosecution also wanted to stress that no one was safe from the Ripper crew.
We were trying to portray that these were random people. Here's a woman that is walking 8:15 on a Saturday morning to her office, and she's brutally murdered.
Even though the state had built a solid circumstantial case, which included the Cocorales brothers' confessions, they lacked physical evidence connecting their suspects to the crime.
The descriptions by Andrew Cocorales and Thomas Cocorales confirmed in our minds that they were there. But DNA was not something that was done at the time. Lori Borowski was found and it was skeletal remains. There was no semen, there was no blood, there was no fingernail scrapes or anything like that.
Fortunately for the prosecution, the judge allowed many of the Ripper crew's previous crimes to be introduced in court.
Andrew Cocorales and his group of individuals had a modus operandi when they killed and murdered Lori Borowski. The same van was used in all of these abductions and murders. These women were abducted in public places. They were taken to secluded places, and they were not robbed, but they were murdered, mutilated.
Andrew Cocorales took the stand in his own defense, testifying that his confession was coerced.
His defense was the police provided all of the details of the murders, and he just really repeated what they wanted to hear.
He tried to say that the police mistreated him, the police abused him.
But jurors didn't believe him. After a short deliberation, they found him guilty of capital murder. He was sentenced to death.
This jury had no qualms. They came back for the death penalty in less than an hour.
Prosecutors were convinced it was a fitting end to one of the state's most horrible cases.
These guys are the poster boys for the death penalty, the worst of the worst. I don't think I've heard one this bad. 30 years later, it still disturbs me.
The sadistic nature of the Ripper Cruz killings still haunts Detective Milner to this day.
Certainly, when you kill somebody, that's just, you know, it's terrible. But when you torture somebody, that raises it to the level, in my humble opinion, of just very, very evil.
The investigators who work the case take solace in the fact that the gang is no longer a threat to society. But Lori's family will never understand the level of cruelty that was inflicted on their loved one.
I think she suffered. I think she suffered quite a bit. Nobody should suffer that much. She didn't deserve that.
In March of 1999, Andrew Cocorales was put to death. He was the last inmate in Illinois to be executed before the state abolished the death penalty. But even that final act of justice is cold comfort for Mark Borowski, who will always feel the pain of losing an older sister, a mentor, and a good friend.
She was always there, you know.
A whole life.
A whole future.
A whole generation.
Yeah. And you can't replace that.
Police were never able to prove that the alleged leader of the Ripper Crew, Robin Gack, was involved in any of their murders. But the group's lone survivor was able to identify him as her attacker. Gackt is currently serving a 120-year sentence for attempted murder. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.